assuming, now what is today, so I say the right thing. Okay, it's the 30th of September, 2010. I recently wrote to somebody that said I was going to be there in August when I meant October. I would say this crazy not to know what the date is. Okay, and we're in Radhadesh, and we're going to look today at enculturation, or basically the relationship between a religious society and outside cultures. Before we do that, we're going to look some more at organizational structure, which we talked about yesterday. So can someone explain to me the relationship between organizational structure and organizational culture?
Form follows function.
Form follows function. What's more important, structure or culture?
Culture.
Culture. What happens if the culture you're trying to have and the structure you have don't match? A lot of difficulties. You know what? It's something like we have a body and a mind. And if I'm doing opposite things with my body and my mind, so if I'm serving Krishna with my body, but my mind is always on something else, well, what's going to happen? Basically, one of two things has to happen.
You don't move forward, or you go down.
Be a little bit more specific. So my body's doing devotional service and my mind's thinking about something else. What will happen after some time? One of two things has got to happen.
You pick one round.
Either my mind will have to follow my body or my body will have to follow my mind. So I'm thinking about other things. Eventually I may do those other things. Or eventually I might decide to start thinking about what I'm doing. But how long can you go on being divided? We tend not to want to do that. So in an organization also, an organization is going to, the culture will either follow the form or the form will have to adjust to the culture. All right. That was interesting. I ended up finding out today, and I didn't have time to get into it more, that Mintzberg later decided that maybe there was a sixth form that just applied to missionary organizations. And that would definitely be equivalent to more of a clan culture. But as I said, I didn't have the time to really explore it. Oh, I see. You have one of those adapters that don't have the... it's not grounded. All right. So, who can tell me which of the five structures are high in centralization? Without looking, preferably. Which of the five structures?
Simple
structure. And? What other structures are high in centralization?
Functional. Mechanic. Bureaucracy.
Mechanical bureaucracy.
No.
Machine bureaucracy.
Right.
That's
so bad.
Is that right?
Yep.
That's
okay.
Fine.
Which of them are high in bureaucracy?
Both the bureaucracies.
I say machine. Is professional really that?
Yeah.
Isn't the divisional could be more?
Divisional is odd.
It's more.
Because you're combining different forms. Where is the control in a simple structure? Where's the control?
Apex.
Okay. In a machine bureaucracy, where's the control?
In the
the techno structure.
Yeah, those people.
The people who decide what the standards are. Okay, in a professional.
In the core members. No.
Operating.
In the operating.
high level work, and the professionals themselves are the ones who hold the control.
In the divisional,
in each department head, which is the line, middle line.
The middle line. And in the adhocracy.
The people down low.
People down low, not the professional bureaucracy.
The brahmanas, or the thinking people.
The thinking
they
people.
Are the
support staff.
Yes.
How is their power? What's the process?
Simple goes top down, vertical.
Okay. Giant Tiger, how is their, where does the power come from in the machine bureaucracy?
How is their power?
Where does it come from? What's the mechanism of power? So in a simple structure, the mechanism of power is I say you do. Or you say I do. That's the mechanism of power in a simple structure. What's the mechanism of power in a machine bureaucracy?
I pay you, you pay you, I pay you.
No, not at all.
Is it supervision?
No. Supervision is a simple structure. Yes.
Does it make the rules? Is that it?
Well, the people who make the rules, we already said that. That's where the control is. The people who make the rules, that's where the control. How are things controlled? So how are things controlled in a machine bureaucracy? Division is in the divisional form. In a machine bureaucracy, Manu, how are things controlled?
I'm confused.
By standardizing
the work, I mean the product.
The way things are done.
Yes, what the process. Mm. The way you have power is you have a standardized process. Everyone has to do things in this way. In an adhocracy, what's the mechanism of power, you mean?
Mutual justice.
What does that mean?
They agree on.
If I over it, they agree.
Something like that. You collaborate.
It's not a vote.
Collaborate. You work together in different teams. An adhocracy means constantly shifting teams. Constantly shifting teams. We're people working together. People communicating, working together, discussing, trying things together. Okay, Manu Kanya, how is their power in a professional bureaucracy? Without looking. Krishnadas.
Power in a professional bureaucracy?
Mm-hmm.
Standardize the skills.
Yes, standardize the skills.
But can I ask a question? If you're standardizing the work and skills, how does that relate? It's horizontal? I don't know. I still don't get this.
Okay, so the way that, so how do you standardize skills? What's the way of standardizing skills? Through what? How do you make sure everybody has the same skills?
You teach them.
Yes. Exactly. So the people who are controlling professional bureaucracy are the teachers. So if you're a professional bureaucracy of doctors, who's controlling that? The people in the medical school.
They
give the same. Who's controlling what happens in a hospital? It's the people in the medical university who are standardizing the skills. They're the ones controlling. The doctors are controlling themselves.
So that's horizontal. What does that mean? With this?
Well, there's not, you're at the bottom line, and there's very little control the administrators have in a hospital over what the doctors do. They don't even understand what the doctors do. Now, as I say, what's happening, is that there's a move towards making professional bureaucracies into machine bureaucracies. There's a move in schools and in hospitals to saying, okay, all teachers have to teach in this way. All doctors have to do in this way. This is the disease, this is the procedure. But of course it doesn't work because teachers and doctors are dealing with
living things.
It just isn't going to work. Okay, what's the process of power in a divisional structure? Mine.
I'm honestly having a hard time to follow that.
Okay. Try to say more. There you go, Krishna. Okay, so divisional is standardizing the output. Let's go for this. Several things. We're looking at, is it centralized or not? We're looking, is it bureaucratic or not? Bureaucratic means that there are, the things are run, remember? Bureaucratic, the cultures, bureaucracy is based on what? Follow the
rules.
Bureaucratic means rules. When we say how bureaucratic is it, we mean to what extent is it controlled by rules. What do we mean by centralized?
Where is the power?
If power is coming from one place.
Power is coming from one place. How do we define power? What's power in an organization?
Who has the ability to control all this? IA, whatever those names. IACAEA.
Okay, this is?
Information. Advice, choice,
authorization.
Execution.
Okay, so centralized means to what extent all these things are in the hands of what, Nitaigor? What does it mean centralized? Jenny, take one. What do we mean by an organization is centralized? It means what?
The organization is centralized.
What does that mean?
It means that power comes from one place.
What do we mean by power? How do we define power?
Where the different directions are coming from.
Okay, can you tell me what this is, please? Try to tell me. Go through it.
Information.
Alisa, go through this one. I'm going to ask you.
Information.
Manukari, what's this one?
Advice.
Good. What's this one?
Choice.
Good.
Authorization.
Execution.
Action.
What does centralization mean? What do we do?
That's the power, basically. That's the process, and the power is in one place. And
it would mean that. Give me a whole sentence. Do you think since Prabhupada said. Since Prabhupada said that if we centralize and have bureaucracy, our movement is spoiled, that this might be important to understand what the heck bureaucracy and centralization are?
Yes.
Please give me in a sentence a definition of centralization.
Okay. centralization signifies that the power is
the power to do what?
To make the rules and in a bureaucracy, to
not to make,
make choices, and that whole execution, everything. All
yeah,
those,
all those things are
those things. In
what?
One place.
In one place, or in the hands of what? Money.
Well, it's who makes the decisions.
Okay, remember that the most essential feature of power is what type of tiger of all these? What's the most essential feature? What you have to have power. Which one do you have to have at least to have power?
Authorization.
Authorization. That makes sense, because an authority has to have the ability to authorize something, to say this is what should be done. If the only thing that the authority has the power to do is authorize, do you have a centralized system or a decentralized system?
Decentralized
system. Give me one sentence again that explains what is a centralized system. Krishnadas.
Centralized system is when like one unit has the control over all those like information, advice, choice, everything.
Okay. At least the minimum.
Basically, when one small area of an organization, either one person or one small group of people, are in charge of a lot of these things, if not all of these things. Now, let's. What would be the most centralized situation possible?
Dictatorship.
A dictatorship, where
one person
controlled everything. So if you had one person that was fully in control of all of this, that would be the most centralized possible. Now, it's very unlikely that you're going to have very many situations where one person is in charge of all. It might happen in what? What kind of a situation would you have where one person might be in charge of everything here? What structure?
Oh, the simple.
Very
simple structure.
You have to be a very simple structure. You have to be a very, very simple structure. There couldn't be very many people under the boss in order for the boss to have, for the one boss to have 100% control over all that. And what's your most decentralized system?
Division.
Is just to describe it to me. Because every organization has someone you call boss. Just like in ISKCON, we have RGBC chairman who would be the boss. So in a decentralized system, your boss is going to have only
authorization.
Ad hoc.
Yeah, ad hoc. It would be the least centralized. Okay? Is that clear? You understand what centralization means now? If I ask you tomorrow what centralization, you'll be able to tell me.
Yes.
Okay, I will ask you tomorrow. What does a bureaucracy mean? What do we mean by a bureaucracy?
Follow the rules.
Follow the rules. That's a bureaucratic culture. A bureaucracy is something that maintains power through rules. Bureaucracy is something that maintains power through rules. So you can have rules about three different things. You can have rules about, you know, you want to have rules being same. When we say everything's governed by rules, we mean that there's some sameness to things. So you can say, I want the same, or I want standardization. Standards, there's standards, there's rules. So we want to have everything the same about what? What are the three things we can have everything the same about?
The way things are done.
The rewards and punishment are what happen when you break your phone.
For the vision is like the product.
The product? Or? Skills. You can say everybody has to do things the same way, everybody has to produce, you could say, all right, everybody has to produce, you've all got to produce a clay pot that's 3 inches in diameter and 4 inches high. Go do it. So you can do it, and you can bring different skills to that, and you can do it in different ways, but I want it to look the same. So that's the same product. We want to end up with the same product, but you could have very different training, and you can do it in very different ways. Is it possible to produce the same product in different ways?
Yes.
Okay. So then we can also say everyone should do everything the same way. By the way, if you do everything the same way, are you necessarily going to get the same product? Maybe.
That is the idea.
That is the idea. So you could say that if you're standardizing the way, you're probably also standardizing the product. So it's further standardization. The least standardization is skills. If I say, all right, I'm going to give you all the same training. You're all going to get a standard training. So that we'll assume... I mean, a good example here is Bhaktivinoda College, where we don't standardize training. For example, this course that I'm teaching was taught previously by Burke Rochford, and it was taught before that by Kurtamisha. They did not teach the same things I'm teaching. They taught some of the same things I'm teaching, and they taught some things that were radically different than I'm teaching. And I'm teaching some things that are radically different from what they're teaching. So that means... that a student who graduates from Bhaktivinoda College having taken Burke Rochford's course and students who graduate from here having taken my course are going to have a different set of knowledge. Because he covered different areas. He looked at ISKCON and society and said, oh, this is what it means. And Kurtamisha said, oh, this is what it means. And I said, oh, no, this is what it means. Now, my course is closer to Kurtamisha's than it is to Burke's. But my point is we don't standardize skills. Or similar things happen with Bhakti Shastri. So there's lots and lots of places in ISKCON that teach a Bhakti Shastri course. I absolutely guarantee you that you will not learn the same thing in every course. There's not going to be the same emphasis. There's no effort in ISKCON to say that everyone who takes a Bhakti Shastri course should learn how to do the same kind of things. I'm not saying this is good, I'm not saying this is bad. I'm just describing something. Or even if you join a temple, do we make sure that everyone who joins a temple, that anyone who joins ISKCON will learn a particular set of skills? Do we have like a skills manual?
Maybe a Bhakti book.
But is that done? Is wherever you join ISKCON, are you going to get a certain set of skills? No.
Basics?
You might. You might. But then again, you might not.
Don't you put on a belly?
Probably. You know, I mean, I know people who've been members of this country for quite a while and don't know how to put on tilak and don't know how to chant their beads. I mean, someone has to, we don't necessarily have an organized program for that. We don't have, you know, people talk about it, but we don't really have something like that, where if you decide I want to become a member of ISKCON, I want to prepare for initiation that will say, okay, these are the skills you have to know. Mm-hmm. We have a list of philosophical questions and mostly organizational questions like what do I do if my knee falls down kind of thing. But we don't have a skills test. The town president doesn't test, do you know how to finger your japa beads? Do you know how to put on tilak? Do you know how to say prayers? Like that Guru Kuli from New Governor was telling me he knows 2 Bhagavad Gita verses and the first line to a whole bunch of songs. Or like my sons went to the Vrindavan's Gurukula, one of them came back knowing all of the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita and one of them came back knowing all the 11th chapter. And I thought, you know, if you're going to learn a chapter, why not learn the 9th chapter? Why not learn the first chapter? It was odd. So there's not a standardization of skills. You can't say if you go to a school connected with the Hare Krishna movement, any school, that you're going to get a certain set of skills. But the idea is that if you go to any medical school, at least within a particular country,
that you can figure that any doctor who goes to medical school in America will have a certain set of skills. That probably isn't absolutely true, but that's the idea. And it probably is pretty close to true. Does that make sense? Now, if we all have possessed a certain set of skills, we may still do things in very different ways. We may use our skills differently. And the result we get may be very different. Is that clear? So let's say we've all been trained, we've all gotten the same set of cooking skills. We've all taken a cooking course, and in that cooking course, we've all learned exactly the same skills. Does that mean we're going to cook in exactly the same way? Mm-hmm. No. And does that mean that our preparations are going to taste exactly the same? No. We can take those skills and we can use them in very different ways. So standardizing skills is the least of the bureaucratic methods for controlling an organization. And that puts the power in the hands of the... Who has all the power, really, in an organization where you standardize skills?
The teachers
really have all power. Because they're the ones who are teaching those skills. And then, of course, within the organization itself, the people using those skills have all the power because they're deciding how to use those skills. Yes?
And the teachers, they might be teaching this due to something else.
They could be.
Because you use medical, so we hear that the English medicine is, instead of Ayurvedic,
yes. Yes. They may have a political reason for why they teach particular skills.
Yeah, I hear the pharmaceutical companies.
Oh, yes. I mean, for example, it was very interesting. My youngest son and his wife just had their first baby. And her mother's a nurse, and at first she was just like, well, I'm just going to go to the hospital and do whatever they tell me, sort of thing. And I've delivered like 50 babies, or helped deliver about 50 babies. And it's kind of, I don't do so much anymore now that I'm trying. But I ended up giving them tons of propaganda, tons of books, and tons of videos and stuff like that. And in one of the videos, they were asking these doctors, how many of you have ever seen any natural birth? And a lot of the doctors said, never. We've never seen a natural birth. Now, of course, how could they help a woman to have a fully natural birth if they never even experienced it? It would be impossible. And my son said, they asked the doctor at the hospital that question. They said, how many natural births have you seen? And the doctors all said, none. So that means that the people who are training them are training them in a particular way. So the people who are giving the training, of course the people who are giving the training in a professional bureaucracy are also usually part of that profession. So teachers are training teachers, doctors are training doctors, etc. Okay, now your next level of intensity of rules is if I also standardize the process. No, I think the next one is if I standardize the product. That'd be the next level if I standardize the product. So if I say, okay, I want you all to have the same product. That's a higher level of standardization. It's a tighter level of bureaucracy. Because if I'm teaching with different skills, I'm not expecting all the same product. I'm expecting one kid to end up to be a mathematician and one kid to be a geologist and one kid to, I'm not expecting everybody to turn out the same. I'm not looking for a standardized product. So as soon as I'm looking for a standardized product, then it's going to push me to try to do things in the same way, yes?
Well, it's how can we standardize product? Because people are different. In this sense that you're saying. How can you all your children become mathematicians if someone...
Well, that's why you're not likely to use a divisional form so much for a school. But they try to do that. You know, again, there's an effort in modern education to try to have all the kids have the same product, to try to have all the kids, you know, be able to get the same grades on the test and know the same things. There's an effort like that. Isn't there?
Yeah.
There's definitely an effort to set up a school in such a way so that the teachers all have the same skills, they all use the same processes, and they all get the same product, like a factory. And then higher level of standardization is if I say you've all got to do it the same way. That's the highest, most intense level of rules following. Now, if you're all going to do it the same way, well, you have to have You have to have the same skills in order to do it the same way. And if you have the same skills and you do it the same way, you're probably going to get the same product. So if I say, okay, we want the, we just like in mathematics, if I give you a mathematics question, there may be a right answer, but there might be many ways to do it. I mean, my younger son again, who's definitely a mathematical genius, he was able at a very, very young age to understand high mathematical concepts. And he would almost always be able to figure out mathematical problems without going through the whole step-by-step process. So for myself, when I was his teacher, I encouraged him to do that. But he said one of the problems he had once he went to college is that his teacher not only wanted to see the answer,
they
want to see the process. They not just don't want to just see the process, they want you to follow the process that they're teaching you. So if you get the correct answer through an alternate process, they would mark your grade down. For example, Vedic mathematics is teaching a very different process than what's taught in most modern institutions. Of course, you get the same answer because in mathematics, generally speaking, there's only one right answer. So that's an example of getting the same identical product. Everyone turns out with the same answer, but they've come to it through a different process. So once you standardize process, then you're also really standardizing. I mean, if you all follow the same process, how likely is it you're going to end up with a radically different product? So therefore, the most bureaucratic is where you're standardizing the process. And what's the structure where you standardize the process?
Machine
bureaucracy. So in machine bureaucracy, you're standardizing the process. As soon as you standardize the process, you automatically have to have some standardized stills, and you automatically have those standardized product. And where do you standardize the product? Jaya Tagore, in what form do you standardize the product?
In
which form do you standardize the product?
Bureaucracy. That's what we're talking about.
Yes, we're talking about bureaucracies. In which form do you standardize the product? Yes, in a machine bureaucracy you do, but you do it indirectly by standardizing the process. In which organizational form is your concentration on standardizing the product?
Divisional,
yes. So that gives you more freedom. I'm giving the divisions more freedom. I'm saying in each division, okay, we want the same product, but you can do it your way. You can do it in your own way. However you want to do it. Okay, and in which one do you standardize the skills? In which form do you standardize the skills?
Machine,
you standardize the?
Process.
Yes, ma'am? Professional bureaucracy, you standardize the skills. Now, the reason standardizing skills doesn't necessarily standardize process is I can choose from a whole plethora of skills. I mean, like for me as a teacher, I've got a really big toolbox of skills that I can draw from. So if I'm going to teach a class, I've got, about 200 different ways of teaching a class because I can put together my skills in various ways. Now, I tend to have certain ways of teaching a class that I do over and over again because I found them comfortable. So I tend not to use all the tools in my toolbox, but I have them. And you can see that many, many teachers who've been trained in the same skills are still going to teach in different ways because they're going to put their skills together differently. Okay, is that all clear? So all three of these, what are the three that use bureaucracy? Professional bureaucracy?
Divisional
form and?
Simple.
Machine? No, simple design is good. And?
Machine bureaucracy.
Okay, those three forms, the way they regulate things is through rules, it's through standardization. That's how they regulate things. If I regulate things through rules and standardization, I have a mechanical system. If the way I get keep the organization together, if the glue that keeps the organization together is rules, I have a mechanical system. In a simple structure and an adhocracy, how are things kept together? Through what? Why are those both called organic systems? Because things are kept together through what? People's relationships. So in a simple structure, it's the idea that one person or a group of people are the boss and the other people are the followers. And in an adhocracy, they're all pretty much equals, taking different roles. But it's still relationships. It's not rules. It's not standardization. So the simple structure and the adhocracy are not relying on standardization. What's the problem with the simple structure? A simple structure can only work when an organization is
small.
What's the problem with an adhocracy?
Inefficiency.
It's not very efficient. Not very efficient. And what does it not give to the people working in it?
And it's stability.
It doesn't give a feeling of stability. If you wanted to say, okay, I want to know what to do and how to do it, you wouldn't be able to function in an adhocracy. Or if I want to know, okay, who's in charge here? Who's in charge of what? Who do I talk to?
Oh, yeah.
Then you have to say, well, okay, well, this person's in charge. It's very fluid. There's some uncertainty. Oh, I didn't bring my project down with me to show you. I'm going to show you a project that we completed through an adhocracy form. So adhocracy doesn't mean that there's nobody in charge. It just means that there's some fluidity. It may be changing. There aren't set groups. And people are bringing different sets of skills, and they're collaborating with each other and discussing with each other. All right. Is this now a lot clearer? Okay, so we have two organizations that are run through relationships. One that's run through a hierarchical relationship and one that's run through a peer relationship. Those are organic because they run through relationships. And we have three kinds of organizations that run through standardization. One standardizes skills, one standardizes process, one standardizes products. Right? So now let's look at culture. So we have, what are the four kinds of culture? There are four kinds of culture.
Market.
I thought there's four kinds of social structure.
No, it's five kinds of social. This is not social. This is organization. It's five kinds. One, two, three.
Well, these are social.
This is structure.
Oh, that's culture.
This is culture.
Plan.
Okay, what are the other two?
Clan
and
bureaucracy.
All right. Simple structure. What kind of cultures could a simple structure facilitate?
Clan. Clan.
Definitely. Machine bureaucracy.
Myocracy.
Professional bureaucracy.
Market.
Divisional.
Depends. Bureaucracy or market.
I think I could also possibly do clan. Because if you have a large family, it might look something like a divisional structure. We don't see too many large families anymore in the world. But if you see...
My family love.
You have a large family. So especially if you have a large extended family. You know, like China is trying to destroy the family. Mm-hmm. You know how they have like two, three generations where you can only have one kid? So if families can only have one kid, that means nobody has any brothers or sisters, aunts, uncles, or cousins.
Whoa.
Imagine, huh?
We haven't.
No brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, or cousins. They're starting to ease the world because they're seeing it's destroying their society.
Whoa.
But their goal is to try and reduce the population?
Their goal is to reduce the population.
So they're killing men and
they
kill men.
That's a poor Christmas.
Huh?
That's a horrible Christmas.
Yeah, it's horrible in general. It's horrible in general. No brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, or cousins. So if you had a large family, if you had, you know, the grandfather, and if they had 10 kids, and each of those had 5 kids, and if you had a whole extended family, and your aunts and uncles came, and your other cousins and in-laws, and you might very, very well have a clan culture in a divisional form. Okay, and anocracy obviously is that. So we see a few interesting things. We see that a machine bureaucracy is probably not, will probably not help you to have any culture other than a bureaucracy. It's going to be pretty hard to have, I mean, maybe you can have a market culture in a machine bureaucracy, but I really don't think so. I think a machine bureaucracy is really going to just build a, just follow the rules. Because if you standardize the process, you pretty much standardize everything.
Are we in a machine bureaucracy?
Thank God, no.
But some countries do look alike. I mean, do look more like a machine bureaucracy.
Yeah, and there's there's definitely a push by some people in ISKCON to bring us to a machine bureaucracy. Definitely. There's definitely a push to bring us to a bureaucratic culture and to have a machine bureaucracy. Although I think if you put it that way to people, they back down from it. Now, what I'm seeing is that, I brought this up before, is that when people read these instructions that you all read from Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta, that their response is, well, but Bhaktisiddhanta had an institution. This is my experience. My experience is that when I bring up to somebody that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati made these statements and Srila Prabhupada made these statements, they'll say, but Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati started an institution and Srila Prabhupada started an institution. Which comes back to what you said. When you said, what did Jaini Tagore say? What were the two words he used?
Spontaneous and controlled.
Not controlled.
Regulated.
No.
Stay.
Organized. Organized. You said, should it be spontaneous or organized? So what happens is that people think organized must mean a bureaucracy. They don't know that there's more than one way to organize. It's not that there's only one way to organize. And the fact that Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta both organized and talked against, now they not only talked against bureaucracy, they also talked against
centralization.
What are my decentralized ones here? Which of these? Which other ones are decentralized?
Divisional.
And?
Professional.
These are my decentralized.
Why professional?
Because professional, the power is spread out over your operating core. In the professional bureaucracy, all of your professionals have power. It's not centralized. Okay? Like here in the college, the people who have the most power are your teachers. That's very decentralized. What's really going on in the college here is up to the teachers, mostly. Not entirely, mostly.
Is that...
That's very highly decentralized.
Is that a common in Columbia University?
Oh, definitely.
It is?
Definitely. They're highly decentralized. mean, the professionals won't have it any other way. You try to centralize professionals, they'll quit. They won't tolerate it.
No, professionals.
Well, I mean, it's normal because they're vaishyas, and vaishyas, they don't work like shudras in the sense that they work for someone else and they have to follow certain
professionals
criteria.
Are more.
Well, it depends who the professionals are. You know, I believe that a lot of professionals would rather, they push their organizations to be like this. And often what happens is among the professionals themselves, they've got an adhocracy. So among the doctors or among the teachers, says there's an adhocracy. But if you look at the university as a whole, or if you look at the school as a whole, you've got a professional bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
And the professional bureaucrat, the bureaucratic nature of the organization drives the professionals nuts, but they tolerate it because they don't know how else to function. They don't know how to have their own, they don't know how to be independent. Now, even though a simple structure is very, very centralized, you know, if you have a lot of little simple structures, your whole organization is not centralized. Then it becomes more like a
divisional
form. So if all of ISKCON is one big simple structure, which it couldn't be, it would collapse. It wouldn't be able to do it.
Wasn't it in the beginning?
Not for very long. Not for very long. I mean, one of the most interesting things that Srila Prabhupada did was that Srila Prabhupada got it away from being a simple structure very fast.
And a divisional.
Prabhupada pushed it to a divisional structure very, very quickly.
Like when Mukunda
and Janaki went to San Francisco. And then it was, I think, in 1970 that Srila Prabhupada set up the GBC. So if you consider that the movement really got going in like 66, 67, so he was taking it out of a simple structure very fast. And he was giving power to temple presidents, and he was giving power to the GBC. And as the years went on, Prabhupada tried to give more and more and more power to them. He didn't want a situation where there was one charismatic leader who was doing all those aspects of power. Prabhupada did not have all the information about ISKCON. Prabhupada wasn't even doing all the authorization. He was having people at a local level do the authorization. He was only doing the authorization for major things. In fact, to a large extent, it was so decentralized, even when Prabhupada was here, that I personally saw temple presidents just refuse to follow Prabhupada's instructions on things, which drove me bananas. And in contrast, you'll see other Vaishnava organizations where you've got one person who's really running the show. They're trying to have a simple structure, even though it's becoming a larger and larger organization. And it can't work. A simple structure cannot work in a large organization. Even Krishna doesn't set up the universe as a simple structure. All right. So, any questions on this before we go on to something quite different? So, we've been looking at here. Let's take a little review of what we've done so far in this course. I'm going to do that again on Monday. So, we started out. Our first class was about the philosophy of science and the philosophy of research, and there we talked about what. Paradigms. And how do we know what's... How do we know what? What's true? Okay. Second class, we talked about sociology. What do we discuss then? Like what?
Functionalism,
Marxism, feminism. We talked about what is sociology. All right.
Next class, we talked about sociology of religion. And what did we talk about there?
Identity
formation.
Identity formation.
Not yet. No. Sociology of religion. What did we talk about there?
The different types of identities.
No, not identities yet.
I mean the different types of
the feature groups.
Different types of groups, like what?
Church,
okay, you all remember that? We were trying to figure out what his come was? Okay. Now that was looking at a religion in terms of how do you decide if something's a church, a sect, or a denomination?
Institution?
What sort of things do you look at? How does it relate to society?
The external aspects.
A lot of you're looking at the external aspects.
And how we see ourselves. These bubbles, right?
Mm-hmm.
How others see us, how we see others, and how we see ourselves.
Mm. Good. Worked out.
Secularization.
We looked at secularization. And we looked at secularization in terms of how does religion affect society? Do certain religions make society more secular? And as far as where something is a sect or a cult, that has to do with how did the religion begin? Why did the religion begin? What are its claims? Why do people join? What relationship does it have to the society? How much power does it have in the society? What relationship does it have to other religions? Okay, then we looked at identity. And what do we look at in terms of identity?
How we integrate religion into our lives.
How we integrate religion into our lives. How a religion has something to do with who we say we are and what our life means. Okay, then the next one we looked at was classes and stratification. What do we look at there?
What makes it you're higher up or lower down?
Okay, and what are the kind of things in society in general that determine your class, your status?
Wealth,
education, and
occupation.
And then we talked about, in addition to that, other kinds of wealth besides money. We talked about two kinds of capital.
Cultural capital.
Good, cultural capital, and? What's cultural capital mean? Like, to what's cultural capital mean?
Cultural thing.
Like?
Like arts, or when you travel, like you have a lot of cultural.
Okay.
Well,
Lita, what's cultural capital in ISKCON? Give me an example of cultural capital in ISKCON.
Indian tradition, like Vedic tradition. Something precise.
If you say somebody in ISKCON has high cultural capital for ISKCON, what would they have? What would they have?
Knowledge of the
Knowledge of the Shastra.
Of the norms.
Of the norms of the society. How do we do?
They dress nice, they can do
kirtan. Okay. They know how to wear saris and dhotis, they know how to lead kirtan, maybe they know how to play mridanga. What's the other kind of capital you could have?
Prestige.
These are all things that give you prestige in society. Yes. So money gives you prestige, education gives you prestige, your occupation gives you prestige, your cultural capital gives you prestige. And what other kind of capital?
Social
capital. What does social capital mean, Yimai?
The effect you have who you know.
Who you know. So cultural capital is what you know. Social capital is who you know. What you know and who you know. And what you know, not in terms of education, I know how to add numbers. What you know about your culture. Don't you notice in school they teach you a lot of things that you're thinking, what am I going to use this for? A lot of history and geography and all kinds of things that you're thinking, what's the use of this? A lot of that is cultural capital.
So much.
Do you understand? My mother's giving you cultural capital. Used to be, pre-industrial revolution, that almost the main purpose of higher of college education was just to give you cultural capital. That was it. It was just given to the aristocracy, especially the royalty, to give them cultural capital. Okay, what's our system? What's our Vedic system of stratification? Varnashram. Now, we didn't talk about the ashrams. We talked about the varnas. What are some things we talked about the varnas?
How each mode of nature is connected to them.
Okay.
Who's protecting?
What they protect.
What are the results from the behavior?
Okay. Other things about the varnas?
Relationships
with each other. Well, the more their weakness.
Yeah.
He wants to be connected to culture. Which one fits to which one?
Okay, so we. Yes, we were related. We then related Brahmins to organizational culture. So then we looked at organizational culture, and we looked at organizational structure. Now we're going to look at how we're going to look at a culture from a very different point of view. A very, very different point of view. We're going to have quite a different lens. And quite a different way of thinking about culture. Now, we looked a little bit at the relationship between religion and culture when we looked at identity formation. By the way, what I'm doing in this course is I'm giving you little ideas and introductions to what are large areas of understanding. You're getting, you know, an hour or two or 3 hours of what is a very large area of understanding. So here we're going to look at the relationship between religion and culture. Now here we're not talking about organizational culture. We are not talking about organizational culture. We're talking about societal culture. An organization is a small part of a society. We're talking here about a whole society. Okay, these are the topics we're going to cover. We're going to define culture. And I'm really not going to talk about much about educational culture. I use this presentation for some other purposes. I'm going to skip that. I'm going to skip number two pretty much. Then we're going to look at types of culture. And we're going to look completely different from this. We've got on a different set of glasses. We're going to look at culture in relationship to religion, native and alien. Then we're going to look at relationships between religion and alien culture. And then we're going to look at our discussion of closed, porous, and flexible, which you already read. And then we're going to end the class by, we're also going to talk a little bit about the relationship of secularization and plurality. Okay, so here's another definition of culture. We've had quite a few of them. So meaning, the form of meaning and values. And we talked a lot about how culture is what you believe, how things make sense, what meaning you put on things. Haven't we talked about that a lot? Mm-hmm. Does this mean you're being rude? Or does it mean you're being respectful? Mm-hmm. So we can say that here we're saying, instead of the meaning you give to things, we're saying the culture is things that have meaning. Instead of defining culture as the meaning that you give to things, we're saying it's the things that sells that have meaning. So before we were saying your culture is that if I give you more rice when you ask not for it, my culture is that it means it's respectful. But now we're going to say culture is the way I show respect. So let's just look at it. Are you able to switch gears and switch lenses? Useful
serving. Okay, so in one we're saying, okay, what does this mean? So the first one we said, the culture is, what does this mean? Culture tells me, does this mean I'm respecting you, or does this mean I'm disrespecting you? And then if I have one culture, then giving you rice when you say no means I'm respecting you. If I have another culture, giving you rice when you say no means I'm disrespecting you. So now we're going to reverse this. And we're going to say culture means what you do that shows respect. So here we looked at one action and say culture is the different meanings you give to that one action. Now we're going to look at one meaning and say culture are the different ways you can show that meaning. Something like what I explained to you before, that I could talk about A, B, and C, and I could talk about A, 1, 2, 3. I could talk about B, 1, 2, 3. I could talk about C, 1, 2, 3. Or I could talk about 1, 2, 3 in terms of A, B, C. So I could talk about Ramja Das, Jiva Das, and Gopal Das. And I could talk about how here's Ram Das. How does he chant japa? How does he, how much sleep does he get? And does he get his work done on time? Then I talk about Jiva Das. How does he chant japa? I can talk about like that. Or I can talk about japa, and I can talk about japa in terms of Ram Das, Jiva Das. So first we were looking at culture in terms of, okay, here's one action, how do these different cultures interpret it? Now we're going to look at culture in terms of what do you do? What are your symbols? What are the external manifestations? Okay, so we're going to say that a culture is native to a religion. This is, we're going to have two different kinds of culture we're talking about here. So you can have two kinds of native culture. So one kind of native culture is the culture that existed where the religion was born, where the religion came into being. So that's like Islam. So Islam came into existence in the Middle East. Middle Eastern culture is native to Islam. However, Christianity also came into existence in the Middle East, but Middle Eastern culture is not native to Christianity. What culture is native to Christianity?
Rome.
Yeah,
European culture. Because Christianity never really developed in the Middle East, it developed in Europe. Buddhism was born where? India. But Indian culture is not native to Buddhism.
It wasn't.
Buddhism never flourished in India. So what culture? So what culture is native to Buddhism? Where did Buddhism flourish?
China,
Thailand, Burma. So those are the cultures that are native to Buddhism.
Disappear,
no, where it flourished. Just like some people are born in Africa, and then when they're little babies, they go to Japan. So they feel like Japan is their native culture. At first a little bit, but not much. I mean, like Christianity was in the Middle East for a while too, but didn't really flourish there.
Didn't flourish there.
Where does it flourish? Where is it being nurtured? Where does the religion really develop? Okay, so these are two ways that a religion can have a native culture. And the relationship between religion and its native culture is like body and soul. So religion is providing the meanings. Religion is saying we value respect, we value truth, we value responsibility, we value kindness, we value love of God. And the culture is how it is expressed. So like we value simplicity. We value simplicity of dress. We express that with saris and dhotis. The Amish express it by having no buttons, no zippers, and no bright colors. So we have the same principle, but we're expressing it through very different cultures. Just like you could express things differently through different bodies. So religion is what gives life to the culture, and culture is what allows the religion to express itself. It's how the religion expresses itself. So that's a particular culture. How do you show respect for the deity? You know, in some cultures, when men go to worship, they cover their head. In some cultures, when men go to worship, they uncover their head. You know, before Muslims go into a mosque, they not only take off their shoes, they wash their feet, which is done especially in South Indian temples, also among Hindus. But the Christians don't do that. They don't take off their shoes at all. They'll take off their hat. Exactly. They won't take off their shoes. So the Jewish man will cover his head, and the Christian man will take his hat off of his head. The Muslims, the Hindus, they'll take off their shoes and even wash their feet. The Christians and Jews will not. But everybody has some way of showing respect when they go into a place of worship. Everyone has some way of understanding, I come to a place of worship, I should show respect. Or we also offer, you know, we bow down when we go into a place of worship. So those are different cultural expressions. Okay, we're going to look specifically at Vaishnavism's native culture. Now, I'd like to propose that we have some special situation between the native culture of Vaishnavism and the native culture of, say, Buddhism or Christianity or Judaism. I'd like to ask you, what do you think is special? Yes?
You can't say it only flourishes outside. That's one thing. Because it's both, it also is working out in India.
That's interesting, I never even thought of that. But we haven't yet developed a native culture outside of India. Vaishnavism has not become big enough and flourishing enough outside of India to get a culture that's native to it outside of India. We're relatively small. We're not the dominant religion anywhere outside of India that I know. What's something special about our native culture?
It's the same as in Judaism, with the culture and the, well, Hinduism and Indian culture are so similar. Judaism and Jewish.
I think you're close to it.
I would say that we take from the Vaishnav culture from India, yet we also take from the culture from the place and where we live.
That we're coming to. I'm asking you about our native culture. The native culture, again, is the culture where the religion was born or where the religion flourished. That's our native culture. Christianity's native culture is European. Buddhism's native culture is the Far East. Islam's native culture is the Middle East. Where is our native culture?
India.
India.
New York.
Hmm?
We're talking about Vaishnavism.
Vaishnavism. Talking about Vaishnavism. What is the culture native to Vaishnavism?
India.
Are you sure? What do we say is our native culture?
Vedic.
Okay, we say our native culture is Vedic. What's special about that?
It doesn't exist anymore.
Well, one thing is it doesn't exist anymore. So is India our native, is Indian culture our native culture?
No.
Sort of. Sort of. What else is special about saying that our native culture is Vedic culture? Yeah, we don't know what it is.
We're not really born in it.
We're not. Oh, Vaishnavism was born in Vedic culture. Vaishnavism was born in Vedic culture.
It exists in a culture.
So one problem, one difference is that Vedic culture doesn't really exist anymore. Another problem is we're not quite sure what Vedic culture is. That Indian culture is probably the closest thing we have to a native culture, but it's not really our native culture. What's another thing that's different? Think about the difference between, say, Middle Eastern culture and Islam and Vedic culture and Vaishnavism. What do those two things have that are different about them? What's the difference between Vaishnavism and Vedic culture and Islam and Middle Eastern culture? Yeah, it's old. So go a little deeper than that.
It was far spread.
What was far spread?
Islam was found by one person in one place. Any culture was culture of one.
Yeah. Hold that thought because we'll come to swing with that later. What else can you tell me though about Vedic culture? What's the difference between Vedic culture and Middle Eastern culture besides how big it was? Where did Vedic culture come from?
God.
Where did Middle Eastern culture come from?
Yes, and it comes from God too.
Just something to develop.
It was already there.
It was just something to develop over time and with human beings. And so our claim is, what we're claiming, is that both our culture and our religion are coming from God. We claim that not only does our religion come from God, but we claim that our native culture comes from God. And we're therefore claiming that our native culture is perfectly suited to express our religion. We're claiming that our religion and our culture were designed to go together by the same person. Whereas the native culture of other religions is more circumstantial. Okay, so here's one thing. That do we really know what Vedic culture is? I'm saying regarding aspect of Vedic education, because again, well, that's what this is designed for. Could there be a lot of different cultures within the Vedic? Then we have to ask about India. Would any of us want to claim that everything in modern Indian culture is native to Vaishnavism? I hope not. What problems do we have because our native culture doesn't really exist and we're not sure what it is?
We're trying to make claims about it.
Trying to make claims about it. or trying to find any situation where we can really adequately, a culture that exists on the planet anymore, where we really can adequately express our religion. Okay, I want to, and just go back for a minute, actually. Again, what I don't list here, but what I've just talked about, is that, you know, we have this claim that our native culture is particularly suited to our religion. Oops. Don't do that, computer. Okay. Now we're going to look at alien cultures. So, alien cultures are of three kinds. One kind is that which is native to other religions. So those are local cultures. Then we have two kinds of global cultures. And this we discussed the first day. You guys remember what secular means, right? What does secular mean? What does secular mean?
Worldly,
mundane, where you don't have religion as a guide or as a lens, which is
sure.
So you remember the very first class we talked about two things. We talked about people who say there's an objective truth, and I can know that objective truth through science. And then there's another group that say there's no objective truth, or even if there is one, we can't know it. And if there either is none, or if I can't know it, then whatever view you have of the truth is all as good as any other. Of course, they don't believe that absolutely. Nobody believes that absolutely. Nobody believes that cannibalism and torture, if you have a torture culture, that that's as good as any other. So nobody actually follows them. But these are the two global secular cultures. That both of these are opposed to religion. Both of these are alien cultures to religion. So a particular local culture may be alien to our religion, but native to another religion. So like here in Europe, the culture is still native to Christianity. Not much anymore, because the influence of the global secular culture is so great. But for example, there's going to be holidays here on Christmas, right? Everything's going to be closed on Christmas. Everything's not closed on Janmashtami. There's a day off on Sunday. There's not a day off for Ekadasi. Now, for example, where the devotees live in Alachua, the local grocery stores will have signs up, tomorrow is Ekadasi, next to their potatoes. Because there's so many devotees there. You know, but in most places, European culture is supporting Christianity. It's not supporting being a Vaishnava. You'll get more support for being a Vaishnava in India, especially if you go to holy places like Vrindavan or Mayapur or Tirupati or places like that. So those are the three kinds of alien cultures. So these are cultures that do not support the expression of your religion. Either they support the expression of another religion or they support the expression of atheism, which you could say is a kind of religion too. It's something that deals you meaning. It has also its own meaning and values. Everybody with me? If I asked you to explain this, could you explain this? Because I will ask you to explain it. I will ask you to do something with it. So if there's something that you don't think you could explain to someone else, now ask me.
Oh, this... relativism. And they say it's equal.
Yeah, that all ways of looking at things are equal. And in your readings for today, you had a section on secularism and plurality, correct? Which I asked you to read? Mm-hmm. Right? What was the point he made there? How does the plurality of religion in society lead to secularism?
People start getting into different training.
They develop new things. New religious, like new religious kind of.
Well, how did he say specifically?
New techniques.
How does that happen?
Different things.
How does that happen?
Cognitive contamination.
Huh? Cognitive. How does that happen? How does cognitive contamination happen? What's the process that it happens?
Different kind of values, lifestyle.
Okay, but how does that, you're talking about plurality. How does that cause this?
How does it come about?
Yeah, what's the process?
Rubbing of elbows,
exactly. You talk to people, you hear what they say, you read what they write, and you think, what do you think?
Oh, interesting.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, maybe they have something to say. So instead of just being in your own culture and being told that's the way it is, 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 you hear about people who have other cultures and you think, oh, that's a good point, oh, that's a good point, oh, that's a good point, oh, that's a good point. And this helps bring you to a kind of secularism where you think everything is relative. Okay, so right now we've seen two kinds of native culture for religion. One is where the religion was born, one is where it flourished, and three kinds of alien culture for religion, one that's native to other religions, and two that are global. Yes?
I have a question.
Yes.
Would it mean that if a person goes to another religion, that means the person secularized?
No, not at all. What does secularization mean?
Yeah, I know with Mandingo, but if changes to some other type of.
What? No, that wouldn't be secular. No.
Other practice.
No.
We wouldn't define that as.
No.
Deviation.
Deviation? From what? You wouldn't define as secularization.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Secularization means, what does secularization mean?
Yeah, I know what
that
means.
Tell me what it means.
It means that the aspect of transcendence is not anymore.
Exactly. So you don't, if a society is secularized, what's gone from society? There's no religion in the art. Just like in modern, global, secular society. The paintings, the music, the theater, the movies, the television shows are generally devoid of religion. They may sometimes have some kind of weird concocted spirituality, but they're not generally religious, are they? And secularization of an individual's consciousness means that when they look at their life, they don't have shastra chakshus. They don't see their life through the lens of shastra. What kind of lens do they see their life through?
Science.
What else? Evolution. Well, the reason I'm acting this way, the reason these things happened to me is because this is how I evolved. Or the reason I'm doing things is because of psychology. I had this trauma when I was a kid. You know, this other person had a trauma when they were a kid. So they have some other way of explaining, of giving meaning. Religion is what gives meaning to things. So they have another way of giving meaning to things other than God. So that's what secularization means. So if I change from one religious system to another religious system, I haven't become secularized. I'm sure the religion you left would think you were deviating, and the religion you go to would think you're coming to the truth. But as far as are you secularizing, no. So if you were born in a Christian family, you become a Hare Krishna, your family's not going to think you become secular, although they might think that you've deviated. That's a wholly different question. Nothing to do with our discussion.
Perhaps the standard of practice will be much less. So this means the consciousness secular.
How could be?
To some extent.
It could be that you could switch to a religion that is less religious. So it's possible that you could change from a religion that had more of a religious point of view to a religion that had more of a secular point of view. That's possible. Okay, so religions and alien cultures. So this is a key point here, that if you claim to be a universal religion, if you claim that the meaning, religion is about meaning, If you complain, if you claim that your religion is giving an ultimate meaning, you must contact alien cultures. Why? Why would any religion that claims that we have the ultimate meaning, why would it have to contact alien cultures?
Well, ultimate meaning has to involve everyone, all the cultures.
Yes. No. Oh no, that's not true at all. That's not at all true. This wouldn't be saying that no culture is alien. What is it saying?
Alien to religion.
Oh no, it's not saying that at all. Okay. Culture is how you express your beliefs. So if there's a culture that's derived, like if I believe in relativism, what kind of culture am I going to have? What is a secular, a relativistic secular culture? What kind of behaviors are people going to do? What kind of behaviors do people do with the modern global relativistic culture? What do they do?
Animals.
They kill animals. They kill babies. Those cultural behaviors are not compatible with our religion. Those cultural behaviors are expressions of a different religion, of a different set of beliefs. Those are ways of expressing different values. Our values cannot be expressed in those. It's impossible for us to express our values. I can't express Krishna conscious values by killing babies. Now, I can express global positivism values through killing babies. I can definitely express global relativism values because killing my baby makes me happy. Well, that's what it's about. And anyway, we're just a bunch of machines. And happiness is what I determine it is. If my belief is happiness is whatever I say it is. That we don't believe that happiness is whatever I say it is. So no, if we say that we have a universal religion, then why do we have to contact alien cultures?
Yeah.
If I say that my religion is only for people in my culture, it's not universal anymore. If we think, actually, let's go back to here for a minute. We talked about this in another class. There are some religions that are ethnic religions. They do not claim to be universal.
Judaism.
Orthodox Judaism especially, and the Amish, and the Hindus. The Hindus claim to have an ethnic religion. An ethnic religion does not claim to be universal. An ethnic religion says, this is the religion that goes with this culture. And if you're born in this culture, you have this religion. If you have this religion, you're born in this culture. And our religion has no meaning for anybody born outside of our culture. Therefore, we have no need to take our religion to people in alien cultures. It doesn't have anything to do with them. That's what ethnic religions are saying. Our religion has nothing to do with people who are in alien cultures. Now, I'm not sure how the Hindus and the Amish explain it, but I know what the Jews will say. If you say, well, okay, well, how do all this, you know, the world is mostly non-Jews. Only 0.3% of the world population is Jewish. So what happens to all the other, you know, 0.3%. Hare Krishna. What's that? 99.7% of the world is not Jewish. So that's a lot of the world for whom Judaism has no meaning. So how do those people attain spiritual happiness? Well, what the Jews say is they have a different set of rules. That God gave one set of rules to the Jews and one set of rules to the non-Jews. They say that the Jews have to follow 613 rules and the non-Jews have to follow, I think, 6. So if you want to convert, if you want to convert and be a Jew, they'll say why. They'll say, why would you want to follow 613 rules instead of six? Just stay where you are.
What are those 6 rules?
And I'm not sure if it's six, but it's a small number. I know it's 613. I don't remember the other, but it's a small number.
Or is it 613?
Oh, I don't remember those anymore, my friend. It's been a long time. So that's how the Jews deal with it. That's how they deal with their ethnic religion. I'm not sure how the Orthodox Hindus deal with it. Maybe they say, okay, well, you've got to take birth as a Hindu. That's probably how they deal with it. They probably say, okay, these are all lesser forms, and, you know, eventually you'll take birth as a Hindu, eventually you'll take birth as a Brahmin, and only from there can you get moksha. So what's the use of preaching to anybody? We can't preach to anybody anyway. They have to take many, many births. And I don't know how the Amish deal with it. Okay, so as soon as you claim to be universal, you have to contact alien cultures. And you notice that these other groups, the Orthodox Jews, the Amish, and the Hindus, and I'm sure there's other groups like this too, they actually try to avoid alien cultures, don't they? They try to keep themselves away from alien cultures. You can think about, what's that rule for the sannyasis? The Hindu rule? No traveling over the ocean. Right? Don't even go in the shadow of an untouchable. Okay, so there's three ways.
I'm not sure I understand this alien culture. What is it?
Okay, an alien culture is a culture that's different from the culture that the religion was born in or flourished in.
How does this relate to the religion itself?
Well, it doesn't. It relates to another religion.
So why we have to say about in regard to the universe?
Because if I've got a universal religion, then it's going to be meaningful to people who aren't in my native culture.
Oh, who are in alien.
Who are in alien cultures. And if it's meaningful to them and it will help them, then I want to tell them about it. Then I'm going to be a preaching religion. And if I'm a preaching religion, I'm going to contact people in alien cultures. What would be the reason not to be a preaching religion? It would only be if I say my religion doesn't apply to everybody. That would be the only reason not to preach. I said my religion only applies to people born in my culture. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's three ways that a religion can contact alien cultures. One is if you work in an area of the native culture with persons from an alien culture. So for the purpose of this, we're going to assume that India is our native culture, although we know that India is not really our native culture. It's the closest we've got. Right now, Indian culture is the closest we have to our native culture. We don't have Vedic culture. So one example would be French children going to an ISKCON school in Mayapur. So that means the religion is operating in an alien of its native culture, but with people of an alien culture. Another way is if you're working in an area of an alien culture with people of a native culture. So Indian children going to a Vaishnav school in London would be an example of that. Another way is if it's in an area of alien culture with people from an alien culture. That's like right here. So here ISKCON is operating in Belgium, which is an alien culture, and the majority of people here are also coming from an alien cultural background.
Same culture.
Or other alien cultures. Like me, I'm coming from America. I don't have Belgian culture, I have American culture. But my culture is, the cultural background that I come from is alien to Krishna consciousness, and the cultural background of the area is also alien to Krishna consciousness. Okay, take a 10-minute break. Come back to 5:25.